Hello, enormous world of podcasting and streaming internet radio, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture show for the modern obsessive. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we run up against the curse of the pundit. It's January, so there's nothing coming out, but don't despair, we have a secret plan. Everybody has got an album that only they like, their own private discovery. It might be obscure, it might be brand new, it might even be a bit rubbish, but you love it. So we've taken advantage of the bleak midwinter setting to ask our guests to bring in theirs. Plus, there'll be oligarchy malarkey as we look at BBC One's Russian gangster series, McMafia. And where were you 50 years ago this week? I was lying in a cot staring at a magic round about mobile and wondering whether George Harrison's Wonderwall music was going to invent ambient house 20 years early, but Johnny Cash was performing his infamous show at Folsom Prison on 13th of January 1968. We'll be listening to it again and examining the Cash legacy without ever using the phrase, quote, the man in black, close quotes. So who are these guests who will be helping us with these weighty subjects and exposing their private preferences to the public glare? Miranda Sawyer is an old-school smash hits alumnus, like all the best journos, and now an author and broadcaster. Her book, Out of Time, looks squarely down the barrel of middle age and attempts to deal with the passing of time and all of its sickening crimes. She's also the radio and podcast critic of The Observer, where she named our companion show, Romaniacs, as one of the 10 best podcasts of the year. Hello, Miranda.
Hi, how are you?
Russell and banknotes once more.
Yeah, got brown envelope sliding across the table right now. Now, as an old smash Smash Hits graduate, you must remember that the January famine, where like literally nothing comes out. This is how like Iron Maiden would sneak a number one, would bring your daughters to the slaughter because there were no records coming out. Did you have to deal with it?
Or was well,
it...
we can. It's weird actually because Smash Hits had to deal with it a lot of the time anyway. Because you might have somebody who was number one, and that person would be Elton John, but it wouldn't be suitable for a Smash Hits cover. Do you know what I mean? So you would kind of line people up. There were various kind of Hardy perennials. You know, we could call them. So you know, Brother Beyond or
the Yond
would be there. So they would be. It would be people like the Yond or perhaps you know the Reynolds Girls or someone like that. But you would budget for it. You know, you'd kind of cope and think, okay, this is going to be a bit difficult. So
everyone forgets it had that really weird publication schedule, didn't it? It was fortnightly.
Yes, fortnightly. And actually, it was really good. I really enjoyed fortnightly because basically you had a week of doing absolutely subtle. Yeah. It was brilliant.
I think that was called research, making jokes, and then huge screaming panic.
You know what
I mean?
Yes.
But that suited me.
That's not how all magazines are made, though, surely.
You're a week of doing nothing
and then the panic.
Yeah, but it's not, you know, if you get to kind of women's magazines work like, you know, kind of 6 months in advance and you hand your feature in, like, which for me is just impossible. I'd like to work to the deadline.
To the end.
And you kind of hand in your feature 3 months in advance and then they unpick it all and you have to do it all again because they've got too much time.
Yeah.
Take all the jokes out.
You heard him speaking just for a moment then. Also with us is the sports, music and general stuff writer Matt Allen. His work has appeared in Q, Mojo, Kerrang, Esquire, GQ and 442 magazines. Matt was formerly on staff at Q, where he once conned Alan McGee into offering a gig to a band that didn't exist. He set up a MySpace page for Hope Against Hope,
That's a plausible name,
who were the magazine's work experience kid and his mates. Matt now writes biographies of sports stars, including Usain Bolt, Jose Mourinho and Wayne Rooney, and he still writes about pop music now and again. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be back.
Glad to have you back. How did Alan McGee take it then when you...
Not very well.
You reeled him in like a kipper.
Really badly.
Yes.
It was a real shame because the band that we were actually using, Hal Griff, everyone seemed to like the music.
Because you got a real person to write the music
yeah.
and then front it with a bunch of photogenic
That's
young
right,
lads.
Yeah. And what was sad was that everyone was very interested until they realised that the guys fronting the band weren't actually the band.
Oh. You see, they've just got it all wrong. This is like an ideal pop band, isn't it? What is wrong with them?
I know.
Just put the pretty ones at the front. Doesn't matter if they can't sing or play.
Well, that's how Jake Bugg did it, wasn't it? Jake Bugg,
Millie Vanilli.
Though our legal people have just informed us that there is no correlation between Jake Bugg and Millie Vanilli.
Jake Bugg actually sings his own song. We'll give him that. He sings somebody's songs anyway.
No, it's good time, good fun.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you, by the way, you know, do you ever talk, you're talking about these sports stars and footballers and Jose Mourinho and all the rest of it. Do you ever talk about music with them? Because, you know, my idea of football and music was George Benson in the car.
Footballers and music is a combination that works so badly. I think the only footballer I've spoken to with decent taste in music was Pat Nevin, who was very much into the Cocteau Twins.
I know. He's renowned
Cocteau
for it,
Twins
though,
and My Bloody Valentine and those kind of bands, Mary Chain.
But it's changed a bit, hasn't it? Because they're now, you know, they're kind of into grime now and they're quite, grime is all right.
Wasn't there a really interesting period where one of the guys at Manchester United that used to be heavily into his music was Brian McClair, Chockey.
Yes.
I remember reading an interview with him where he described there was this kind of, when this schism appeared, where all the young guys were coming in and they were all into kind of like hip-hop and stuff. And the old stages were like trying to get, I don't know, level 42, but trying to put, you know, fighting over the stereo in the
Gary Neville had a phase where he was bringing an acoustic guitar on the bus to games.
Yeah. Neville.
I'm sure it was Gary Neville.
Oh my god, that's awful. I mean, actually, you mentioned a level 42 because the shoot fact files of footballers was always favourite music level 42, favourite food steak and chips, wasn't it? And now it'll be favourite music Stormzy, favourite food. We're not allowed food. Maybe like pasta with a bit of lamp placenta on it, something like that.
Broccoli.
Absolutely. You heard him speaking then.
Special drinks.
Yeah, special drinks with crushed herbs in it. You heard him speaking just then. It's our producer, the Hristo Stoichkov of podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Were you ever a devotee of football or music?
No. The two things really, apart from that brief period in the kind of mid-90s, late 80s, early 90s, where the culture's kind of
when you order made a football record, that's basically what you're saying.
You know, but apart from that, you know, and it's kind of that hangover's really, I think that's got a lot to blame that for what's the problems in society at the moment, the fact that everyone needs their favourite football team and stuff, whereas actually before that people would just be like, I don't like football, but now every politician, everyone, you know, so you get kind of like...
Wasn't it Cameron that kind of forgot that...
Aston Villa.
Yeah.
That was Villa, yeah.
Then he said he was West Ham. You obviously got the colours mixed up. Yeah. He was really called out.
I like that jolly coloured one. Which one's that?
Could have been Burnley.
And the royal family all being football supporters, and it's like, no, they're not. That's not their job.
No. Move away.
Anyway, just reminding us all that it's actually a pop music podcast. So we're gonna get back to music. Matt Allen, we're gonna start with your album that nobody else likes. What is your album that nobody else likes?
It's a Golden Dawn Orchestra. Mm-hmm. It's called Stargazer, and they are kind of a weird space jazz rock everything collective from Austin, Texas.
Well, let's have a listen, and we'll talk about it in a minute. Golden Dawn Orchestra from the album Stargazer. This is Space Waves. Space Waves by Golden Dawn Orchestra from the album Stargazer, which is Matt Allen's choice of the album nobody else likes. So, Matt, who are they and why do you like them?
Like I say, they're a weird sort of art, jazz, rock collective from Austin. I first saw them, I went to this brilliant festival out in the desert called, it's in a town called Martha, or actually Marfa, M-A-R-F-A.
Yeah.
Marfa.
Down to Marfa.
Yeah,
down
Marfa.
Don't forget me chips.
Yeah. And it's a really small festival in a trailer park hotel called El Cosmico, where there's these great streamlined... Airstream trailing.
Are you sure you just didn't imagine it?
I did not imagine it.
It's like in a peyote.
It's amazing. And you can do all that kind of stuff and stare at the stars. And they have a festival every year called the Trans Pecos Festival.
And I woke up and I was in a car park in Guildford.
Yeah. And it was great. So the year that I went, it was St. Vincent and Jenny Lewis, Portugal the Man. I think it's about 750 people.
Wow.
You have to watch out for the rattlesnakes and the black widows and that kind of thing. And it's a tiny little stage, and Golden Dawn Orchestra closed it out, and they started on the main stage, and this will sound like I've imagined this, but they start on the main stage and lead a procession through the festival past these hot tubs where one couple assumed that with the lights down they were safe and had taken all their clothes off, and as everyone kind of walks past, to a space at the end of the festival where they played for an hour. And they have that kind of Flaming Lips type vibe where you come away from watching them feeling like you've had a bit of an experience. You know, it's kind of, it's euphoric and it makes you think and it makes you sad. And, you know, it's that kind of whole jumble of emotions you get when you see the Flaming Lips.
I was not expecting to like this, but I really, really dug
it.
It's like, it is ridiculous. I totally dug it.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised because, you know, the listeners won't be able to see your haircut, Matt. You don't look like a space prog jazz madman.
No, I used to when I had more hair, you know. I know what you mean.
I didn't think this would necessarily float
your... Yeah, you
have
perfect turnips. This is so unusual.
I know.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of work.
Miranda, what did you reckon to this?
This is not my kind of thing at all. So I can really understand when you described that. I just thought, okay, now it makes complete sense. This is absolutely the place that you should see, with 750 people off their tits and peyote.
Yeah. People having sex in
hot tubs. People having sex in hot tubs.
Rattlesnakes.
I was surprised. I thought you were going to say that everybody joined in and then they moved on. I mean, I can completely understand it, but it's really not my kind of thing. I really try, you know, as I've got older, I've tried to be more open-minded about things, and I've tried to like this kind of music, and it just does my head in because it goes on too long.
But is there? There's no connection. There's no connection to the orchestra, to Sun Ra's orchestra.
Well, there's a story behind this.
Is there?
Because I did a bit of nosing around.
Apart from obviously the spaciness of it.
On Facebook, in there's a description of themselves on Facebook. It says, Zappo Mgwana, who I presume is the main guy, was born in Washington, D.C. He never knew his father, but his mother, who worked for the Ethiopian embassy, almost told him that Herman Poole Blunt, Sun Ra, was his father.
So imagine being told,
Sun Ra is your dad, and you just went, yeah, okay. Because that's a little bit better than like my dad's Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Or you know, my dad invented the skateboard, but the government took the patent. You know, the usual bullshit the kids come out with. That's fantastic. Also, the best bit of the lot on the Facebook page, it says, artist we also like, Sun Ra. Band interests, time travel.
Like, which is great.
They are so mean.
I take it you saw the photographs of them and
they look fantastic.
Yeah.
Are they rather trippy?
They look like, I think I explained it in the email to you, like a kind of 1970s era Doctor Who intergalactic overlord.
That's very good. I like that look. That look is good.
They look like Earth, Wind and Fire and Time and Space is what they look like. There's headdresses.
All the elements.
Headdresses.
It's like, you know, and they make Goat look like Kraftwerk.
Do they then all go home to their kind of jobs as accountants?
Yeah, well, the main man co-owns a bar in Austin somewhere. I don't know what the other guys do, but yeah, it's
Austin's quite that you know, quite intergalactic friendly. Though,
there is a local campaign, isn't there, Keep Austin Weird?
Yes, there is,
and it's been gerrymandered by the Republicans. So they've got Republican senators and Republican representatives, but the whole place is full of pot smoking, long hair, kind of thing. You like to dress up as Egyptian potentates and levitate a pyramid, all your favourite stuff, you know. I mean, musically, I really enjoyed it because it's like if you got a prog rock band and said, by the way, here's disco, and instead of going, we reject this, they said, yeah, all right, we're on board with that.
It's really funny because most of the tracks kind of started off, and I thought, oh, no, I really like it. And then I just thought, stop now and then goes somewhere else. It's always my classic reaction. I don't know why. I don't like long music very much. It's just, you know, pop. It's a pop kind of.
None of us is getting any younger.
I thought your
comparison to kind of Wayne Coyne's Mob was quite opposite, because I did feel that listening to it, that it's the sort of thing, and what you've just said, that if you see them live,
yeah, sounds amazing.
It'll be amazing. And then every time you put on that, you know, you put on the music at home or wherever you may be, you go like, oh my god, that was an amazing night.
Yeah.
But maybe coming to it just through the kind of through the nudie lady on the front cover.
Well, there is a reclining nudie lady on the book shooting lasers out of her fingers into space.
I'm quite happy about that. I don't mind that. I mean, you know, Peaches have done that, but out of her crotch, so I'm quite happy about
shooting
that.
Shooting lasers out, out of her whatever, as Donald Trump would have
these
it.
These aren't even pretending.
Yeah. I really like this. So that is, when did this come out?
2 years ago.
Okay, so this is the Golden Dawn Orchestra and it's Stargazer, and they look like Jabba the Hutt's palace band, and I recommend them thoroughly. Should we do some telly? Should we get back to Earth and do some telly? BBC One's McMafia is definitely the sort of drama that comes out in January. It's like a quality big ticket thing with something to say, loads of money spent, based on the expose of organised crime networks, drug smuggling and sex trafficking by former BBC correspondent Misha Glennie. It stars James Norton as City Fund manager Alex Godman, and it explores the blurring of lines between finance, crime, property development and the international oligarchy. McMafia is big, expensive, globetrotting and huge in scope, but is it any good? Let's have a taste first.
I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. Educated at a private school in England. I run my own firm in the city. I'm very happy with my life the way it is.
Я не все равно приду за тобой.
On the left is the Hall of Peace. On the right is the Hall of War. Which one would you like to see?
Neither you, your family, nor your father are safe.
To protect your family, this is what you have to do.
A bit of BBC One's McMafia, the 8-part series now on its 4th episode. Miranda Sawyer, what did you make of McMafia?
Yes, I liked it. Hooray!
Yeah.
it's quite slow moving at the beginning. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of an unbelievable element in that our kind of hero, our anti-hero, is supposedly highly upstanding and then very, very quickly is not upstanding at all, which I thought was, a little unbelievable. But other than that, I liked all of it. I liked the kind of Godfather element. So
just set it up for us first.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah. Okay, so essentially what you have is our hero is an incredibly handsome, British-born, has gone through the private school system, hedge fund chappie, who's young and incredibly good looking, but his background is Russian. And so his father is Russian, his uncle is Russian, and they are in Britain because they've kind of been run out of Russia really by some other bad guys. And he has a hedge fund kind of, investment firm, which is completely clean, but he discovers that all the funds are being taken out of it because his uncle is putting pressure for various nefarious reasons. And there's a fantastic murder, I have to say. An absolutely brilliant murder in the first episode, which is completely unexpected and shocking.
Don't
and
tell
really
us who gets
panicky.
Murdered, but it's
I won't
quite
tell you
surprising
what happened,
who gets murdered.
But it was really, everything was kind of ticking over in rather
supremely
classy...
Supremely Russian murder, isn't
it? Yes, it's great. Yeah. And it was, it was kind of ticking over in quite a kind of classy, okay, who, now we understand, bit of intrigue, so... And suddenly this murder completely increased my... It sounds terrible, isn't it? But I liked it after the murder, basically. The murder was absolutely brilliant. And after that, it gets quite hectic. It's just, I slightly question his... we're told for a really long time that he's very highly moral, and then he very quickly is very not.
Well, also
that is the story, isn't it? It's like how thin is the veneer of your morals?
Yes, exactly. Yes, and also, how much you owe to your family
as a bloke who's got the intelligence and the nous to run a kind of international hedge fund. All of a sudden, going, oh. Some members of my family are heavily up to their neck in dodgy
business. But actually, I bought that because he'd been turning a blind eye consciously for such a long time.
Yes.
And, Matt Allen, what did you think of it?
I really liked the first one. Mm-hmm. So I've watched a couple of them now. The first one was great. Like you say, that murder was fantastic.
Great.
And the ensuing panic. There's a few flaws in it. Like you say, he turns very quickly. Some of the Russian cliches jarred a bit. I mean, there's always a bit of dialogue about the quality of caviar in these things. Yeah. You don't want your Russian murderers to be into kind of John Smith bitter and Paul Strachan's. But at the same time, there could be another Russian.
But to be fair, though, I mean, you travel to the United States a lot, Matt, and British people just talk about tea all the time.
I know.
It's like the tea
true.
Is crap, yeah. So
yeah, true.
I bought that, yeah.
Thoroughly enjoyable. I found the second one, I kind of started to lose interest. I'm still trying to put my finger on why. I think maybe... one or two of the characters became a little bit of a grotesque characterisation. The dad is drinking vodka out of a bottle of Evian and that kind of thing, and considering suicide and all that sort of stuff, and it gets a bit...
But although I have to say, I went to Russia on a couple of occasions, mostly through work, obviously, not through anything else.
Yeah.
Franz Ferdinand, as I recall, and was one of the things. And I remember ordering going for a meal and ordering a vodka and tonic. And they went, sorry? And I went, vodka tonic. And they went, okay. And brought me a bottle of vodka and a glass of tonic.
Well, then, look, I stand corrected. Maybe it obviously is the norm.
Well, this is the place where if someone toasts you with beer, it's an insult.
Yes, absolutely.
You've been toasted with vodka.
You know what I quite liked as well? I mean, it's called McMafia. It's a kind of mafia story, so therefore it has to have family, it has to have corruption, it has to have all those kind of things, and it goes across various environs. And all those kind of stories, from The Godfather really to The Wire, are epic stories in which family pulls against morals. And I like those stories.
Yeah.
They're really good.
I went back to, after watching the first episode, I went back and I had the Misha Glennie's book on my shelves.
Yeah.
It came out in 2006 and I started rereading it and thinking, what a shame that they couldn't just transfer the book, because there are stories in the book that are so mad, just insane kind of stories. It opens with a woman being mistakenly murdered in a kind of a development in Esher, I think it is, by some bloke who's took umbrage at a husband who comes from the Balkans, and it's kind of he's like, oh my god. And the point of the book that's interesting is that he traces it all from the Balkans, from the Balkan War, from the fact that when the war stopped, people who were warlords just immediately kind of flipped into being
businessmen.
But, yeah, legitimate businessman.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where it all comes from. Mm. And obviously the problem that the programmer's got is to do that would, A, take a ridiculously long time to explain, but also wouldn't give you that focus on the individuals.
Yeah, so this is essentially a family story, isn't it? And that's what they always have to be, don't they, really? You have to understand.
Yeah.
I mean, right at the very beginning, one of the characters, the uncle character, I kept thinking, oh, my God, he's Fredo. He's so obviously Fredo.
Yeah.
This is
like kind of,
he even looks a bit like Fredo.
Yeah.
It's quite weird. You know, so there's always those tropes that you kind of latch onto. But I did think, you know, the other thing I thought, you know, not to sound too, I don't know, I wanted to use a swear word, though, I'm not going to use it, too sniffy, I think, it looks good, you know.
Yeah.
BBC has put quite a lot of money in it. It looks really, really good. You know, you wouldn't have been surprised if that had come from America. It looks
and
really
And the street scenes
proper.
in Mumbai and the street, the scenes in Tel Aviv and it's kind of, you know, yeah. They've put the legwork in there.
Yes, which is good, you know, because quite often you see things and you think, oh man, that would have been good if you just spent a little bit more money.
Mm. No, if this scene taking place in a hotel room at the Alien Television Centre, it only just takes place in the skyscraper somewhere. One thing that stood out for me was I thought it quite skillfully, although you're being presented with a world of people who are not just criminals, but also, hey, we're English. They're unutterably vulgar. They have no taste. bling and shininess all over the place. Everything is really, really nice.
Well,
but for all of that, it still kind of quite skillfully puts you in, you know, it gives you some sympathy with them. They are the outsiders. The West has given them the high hat since forever. They know that we look down on them, and now they've got the whip hand. They've got all the money, yet there's still that resentment there, which is projected onto the Alex character. Because
he seems so British.
Yeah, you went to a good school. You went to a really,
And also, there's that implication that you don't have any emotion, which is established very early on, isn't it?
Mm.
Well, he's like a wall that you can chuck a tennis ball
against.
There have
been some criticism of him kind of having three.
Facial expressions,
kind of one kind of poker face, one false smile.
And there was a bit of panic in
some
occasions.
One panic.
But again, I mean, I quite like that because, I mean, when you're, I mean, the villain who we eventually meet, you know, at the end of the key bad guy that we meet at the end of the first episode is completely effectless. He's a blank slate.
Yeah.
And that to me is far more. You know, I don't want to see scenery chewing and emoting. I think the contrast between something like this, where there's clearly been, we've got to build a pulse-pounding action narrative into the middle of depicting this world, the contrast between that and the Wire approach, which is you simply follow characters, and the most riveting scenes are often something where nothing at all happens, because the kind of the warp and weft of boring daily life as a Baltimore cop or a Moscow mob guy is actually, you know, it might not be as immediately exciting as a panic room scene with a load of guys trying to kill you.
Yeah.
But it's actually more involving because it gets you inside the head of people that are very unfamiliar to you.
Yeah, I did feel a little bit like, I mean, I think it's changed in kind of episodes 2 and 3, but at the beginning I did feel, you know, because a lot of people, you know, I'm certainly not saying we're incredibly sophisticated, but we've watched a lot of telly by now, haven't we? And I did feel like, you know, I was waiting almost for two or three other narratives to be woven in early on, and they didn't, because we're so used to that, to having a funny character that might pop up later, and that is from The Wire or Sopranos.
Well, I think
have you seen Gomorrah?
No.
Which is fantastic. That's, right. I think if you got Now TV, you can watch that. That's very
that's
dark
exactly what I need. Another 30-piece gigantic thing to clog.
Two seasons, Andrew.
Clogging up my box, as they say.
Sticking to.
So, I mean, just to close out on McMafia, I mean, to me, it was interesting because it kind of, it sort of fictionalises the change in power balance between the way that Britain is going and the rise of Russia. I mean, we have fooled ourselves for decades that we're still on top, and this clearly shows our position, which is we are financial handmaidens to the new rich in the world. We've been like that with the Middle East for a long time.
Yeah. Oh, but luckily we can wear suits, huh? That's thank God for that.
And
we might be wearing suits, but we're still the butler.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
I completely agree. On that element, I quite like it.
There was an article that Luke Harding, who was the Guardian's former man in Moscow, who's much like Glenny, not able to go back to large parts of Eastern Europe anymore. And he was saying that there are some kind of factual things they've got wrong, number one of which, these people who are now kind of in the West do not move without a phalanx of bodyguards. Yeah. Like, literally, they don't go, you know, that is the kind of the badge of honour. But also that this is telling a story which happened 10 years ago. All of this has happened, and this takeover has happened, and what's happening in the city, and what's happening with kind of investments in kind of property and stuff, is all stuff that happened 10 years ago. It's telling an old story.
Just to be honest with him, though, I kind of think extras are really expensive. They're probably as expensive as bodyguards. So I don't want my BBC license money paid on surrounding Uncle Boris with 30 guys who look like brick shithouses in Armani. I think you just go with it, don't you? You just buy it. Should we move on with another album I like? Now we're under Sawyer. Yours is?
Oh, it's like the opposite, isn't it? Of yours, that's so funny.
Couldn't be any more opposite.
Okay, yes. It's Bobby Gentry, Touch 'Em With Love. This is when I was very little. This album came out, I think, 68. I was born 67. Anyway, we had three records. This is how old I am. You know, we had three pop records in the house. We had Petula Clark.
Yeah.
Save me now. We had The Beatles' Hard Day's Night, and we had this album. We had Bobby Gentry's Touch 'Em With Love, and this was my favourite one. Hey, Deacon, won't you lay a little prayer on me? My parade leaves soon, nobody, and I can't be left behind. The Deacon made a jump back, made a high sign, and then he cried, you gotta touch me with love, touch me with love, love. Touch me with love, love, love.
Bobby Gentry with the title track from Touching With Love, Miranda Sawyer's album that nobody else likes. But that's actually quite a stretch, isn't it? Because quite a lot of people like it.
I loved it. Yeah.
I know. I think lots of people like it. It's just one of those albums that I can't... You know, sometimes when you hear an album, like, you kind of know that there's a duff track in it. You know, every album's got a duff track, you know. It's just a fact. And you kind of know there's a duff track, and you think you might know which one, but I can't hear the duff track because I can't find it, because they're all equal in my head, even though... Objectively, you know, if I put my kind of critical hat on, I know that I'll Never Fall In Love Again is the standout track on this. And I can understand that, you know, Where's the Playground, Johnny's a bit naff, but in my head they're the same.
I love that.
Also, she kind of gets past the duff track problem by making an album that's 26 minutes long.
And that's another reason to love this album.
Barely an album, and concise.
There's 10 songs. There's definitely 10 songs. It's just that very few of them are over 2.5 minutes long.
Yes, there's lessons to be learned from a lot of people there. So, I mean, was this her first kind of Nashville record?
So she'd had a big hit with a single, Ode to Billy Joe, and then this was, I think it's her second album actually, but it's quite a well-received album, and it's just at the point where she just becomes massive. So very soon after that, she starts doing lots of duets with Glen Campbell, and she has her own telly show. So she was immensely famous, and she looked, for anyone who doesn't know what she looked like, man, she looked amazing.
She does look pretty amazing.
The hairdo that she's got on the cover
is the best, isn't it?
It's quite obviously was responsible for about 35% of the hole in the ozone layer.
Yes. So it's kind of, she's kind of a bit dressed like an Indian squaw. So she's got kind of fringed suede on, which is a great look anyway, bare feet. And she has this kind of, you know, like the 60s look where your hair was very, very high but slightly loose at the same time. And she's this weird combination of immensely glamorous 60s and country. I mean, that's what's kind of weird about
it. It is that strange moment where kind of country and the hippies cross over, and the kind of counterculture of, as you say, dressing up as a Native American, as we call them now, Miranda.
That's what she was there.
I know. Didn't she also, wasn't there, isn't her backstory that she is part Native American? I think there's a...
Oh, there we are. So it's a big tick, so it's fine. She's allowed.
Yeah. But it's like the counterculture, funk and soul and like funky guitar, transplanted into the very kind of, not just conservative, but actually mainstream. Country was the mainstream of pop entertainment then. I was trying to think of what the current equivalent would be, and I can't imagine what it would be. It would be like
Ed Sheeran.
but I mean, it would be taking somebody from the counterculture, such as it stands, and placing them where Ed Sheeran is, or putting them on the X Factor. It would be putting Peaches on the X Factor or something.
The thing that I always find really interesting about Bobby Gentry is the Ode to Billy Joe thing, and the fact that she doesn't talk about it, and the fact that she kind of is a bit of a recluse now.
She's a complete recluse. You know, the thing that's really amazing about her is she just decided she wasn't interested.
She just stopped.
She's absolutely massive, and she just stopped. And then there's Radio 2 made a really good documentary about it, actually, and there was this moment where one of her old producers got a phone call from her, and at the time he couldn't take the bloody phone call, and then she never phoned back. It was so recent, and she was like thinking maybe she was going to make some music. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Terrible. But the other thing I really like about her, I mean, it's very common with country acts, actually, is that she writes She wrote, so she wrote all her own stuff, and she produced, you know, she produced a lot of it as well. And what she wanted to do, which is incredibly country-ish, is basically tell stories. So people, they listen to Ode to Billy Joe and they want to know exactly who and what and happened. And she's not really as interested in that as in the details in the story. She just wants to tell what the family's like rather than try and work out who did what when kind of thing.
Didn't she cut those lyrics in half at some point and... There's a mystery about
what they're throwing and why and all that kind of stuff.
They made a film out of that song.
Yeah.
They, you know, think of another, you know, possibly Bohemian Rhapsody, but apart from that, you make a big Hollywood movie.
I don't want to see the movie Bohemian Rhapsody. I really don't.
That'd be a space opera.
It would be a 24-part HBO series and it would bore the living arse off you.
We better copyright that
absolutely.
Now, though.
Yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie. Well, one of the numerous interesting things about this is it's kind of like, it's like the alternative Dusty in Memphis, isn't it? It's like the role with it to Dusty and Memphis's country house.
Yeah, that's
parallel. And they are both obviously, you know, absolutely brilliant.
The thing I also think is interesting about it is that, given that we're going to talk about Johnny Cash, one of the things that is interesting about Johnny Cash, or one of the things that we love about Johnny Cash, is he lasted a really long time and he kept working all that time. And that's one of the things that adds to his legacy. And the thing about Bobby Gentry is she just stopped. And if you just stop, that's great on one level because you have your perfect, you know, amount of work. But if she had carried on, she would have been revered like Dusty, you know, because she would just, people would have carried on hearing her and reclaimed her in the way that everybody does as you get older, and she would be almost like more respected, I think, really.
Matt banned a word from the English language last week on the show. He's banned the word banger. We can't refer to anything as a banger anymore. I'm banning a term. Nobody's ever allowed to refer to anything as Southern fried ever again. Southern fried salt. What that means is they made it south of the Mason-Dixon line. Other than that,
there's a record label in Brighton that won a word with you.
Yeah, but I mean, as an adjective, Southern fried. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Johnny Cash. So we're going to talk about Johnny Cash. Let's talk about Johnny Cash. I mentioned it at the start of the show. 50 years ago this week, on January the 13th, 1968, Johnny Cash records his career-transforming album At Folsom Prison. The clue's in the name. Cash had wanted to record an album in a jail ever since recording the song Folsom Prison Blues in 1955. Columbia sat on the idea for 12 years, but by 1967, Cash was over his drug problems, trying to turn his career around. He played two shows at Folsom, backed by June Carter, Carl Perkins, and the Tennessee Three. They produced one of the greatest live albums in history, where the location, subject matter, and artist merge into one. It turned Cash's career around and was the first of four live albums he recorded in jails. We're going to talk about it and the growing obsession with what Cash stood for. After this, live at Folsom Prison, this is Johnny Cash with Cocaine Blues.
Early one morning while making the rounds, I took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down. I went right home and I went to bed. I stuck at 11:44 beneath my head. Got up next morning and I grabbed that gun, took a shot of cocaine and away I run. Made a good run, but I run too slow. They overtook me down in Juarez, Mexico.
Johnny Cash with Cocaine Blues live at Folsom Prison. This is one of the few country live albums that absolutely everybody can get something out of. Matt Hall, you're a bit obsessed with this, aren't you? You're a bit of a...
I think it's a fantastic record. And I think he's a really interesting character. And I think that, as you said, that his career, his interests, what was going on at the record company, what was going on in the wider culture kind of all came together at that. In one kind of point and made an amazing record. And I was thinking about it on the way in today. The really interesting thing, well, for me, is that, or ironically for somebody who was arrested, he couldn't get arrested when they did this. His career was, you know, he'd made 27 records before this. You know, he'd had what by any stretch of the imagination is a career. But yeah, he was on the fade.
But actually, the fact that he was on the fade, it adds to this, doesn't it? Because he's amongst people who've also blown it.
Yeah, and he was really lucky in that he was signed to Columbia, and Columbia at that point were not interested in a washed-up, pill-popping country and western star. However, some new people took over at Columbia, and they kind of cleared out the old kind of country management of the management of the country section, and they brought in this kind of slightly kind of off the wall guy who Cash went in and said, "I want to make a record in Folsom Prison," and he went, "Yeah, great."
All right.
he's famous. He's the Bob that's referred to on the in between one of the tracks when Cash takes great delight in listing all the words that he can't say during the recording, and he just said, "How'd that grab your Bob?"
There's so much stuff. There's so many stories that spin off this record that I love.
Yeah,
and I love the fact that you can go into a prison and sing about cocaine, murder, and whatever, and not be shut down. I mean, I've spoken to quite a few bands, not quite a few, but I've spoken to a couple of bands over last year who play gigs in prison, one of which being Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, the other being Bonnie Prince Billy. And they both love going in there because they have quite literally got a captive audience. But also, they say that they listen. Will Oldham said that people in prisons tend to listen more to the lyrics than at any other gig he ever plays.
Right.
So what you're singing about is so impactful.
Yeah.
So that kind of, in that context, those lyrics become even more dangerous.
Yeah. Miranda, is this album part of your mental furniture?
It is a bit. Yes, I do. I actually do really like it. And listening to it again, the thing that I was struck by, not to sound too nerdy, was the sound is just amazing. Yeah. The sound is just brilliant. And the kind of irony around it is that a lot of the kind of sound from the inverted comma crowd was added later, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So because they weren't allowed to kind of respond to all these songs that you're saying.
Yeah.
The cheer after "I Shot a Man in Reno, Just Watch Him Die" was dubbed on subsequently.
Yes, which is amazing, you know that. I think it's quite interesting because obviously I think the people who did it were probably there and could feel the emotion, but nobody was allowed to respond because you can't say "woohoo, cocaine, woohoo, shooting people while you're in prison."
The crowd noise became such a thing that Sun Records, which Cash was previously signed to, actually went back and dug a load of his old stuff out of the archive and dubbed on kind of random crowd noises and released it, which is just brilliant.
Well, football champion,
a quite significant pop act who shall remain nameless once told me that they would perk up their live recording B-sides and stuff like that with some cheers from a George Michael concert, which is brilliant, and they would just throw them on. And
I do think that myth about playing in prison is really interesting, actually, because I went to it wasn't a gig, it was a performance. Do you know Letters Live? So it was a performance of Letters Live in a prison to raise money for National Prison Radio. Great. And I assumed, because of Johnny Cash, that the audience would be prisoners. You just assume that's what happened. It wasn't at all. They wasn't prisoners. It was people who were giving money, you know, and you could listen to it as across National Prison Radio, across the whole, if you were in prison, you could listen to it across the whole of the country. But I think there's an assumption now that if you take anything musical, that your audience in a prison will be prisoners. Actually, nowadays, that's quite hard to organise. Yeah. It doesn't really happen like that because you don't have the staff, to be honest.
Tough guest list.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, your name's Dan, you're not getting out. While we're talking about jail, if you're listening, you clearly like podcasts. You may know about this already. There's a fantastic podcast called Ear Hustle.
Yeah, it's really
which
good.
I think we talked about this the other day, right? It's basically documentaries made in jail by prisoners. And the first episode is just about how hard it is to find the right cellmate.
So, to share with the right person.
It is an incredible
podcast. There's that brilliant thing, the two brothers share.
I know, yes. I'm going to share with my brother. That's a great idea. And then they just fight because brothers fight.
You know? But going back to this record, that's the kind of slightly funny thing about this is that Cash, his whole kind of post Folsom persona was about the man in black, the man in prison.
You've said it.
I'm sorry,
said it.
But you know, of course, he was actually only ever in jail for one night for being off his head on pills and stealing daffodils, I think, from a civic flower bed when he was on tour, and he was arrested and shoved in the drunk tank and woke up, but got out the next day.
That was one of the times he had one of his revelations, where he kind of somebody spoke to him after being in jail, a sheriff or something, and he did manage to kind of sort himself, because obviously he was in and out of rehab, wasn't he? So he had a time, and this is one of the times when he was kind of sorting himself out, and this was probably one of the reasons why he was able to do that gig. But then he kind of fell again, didn't he?
There's the version of this album that most people are familiar with is the 45-minute original release, but there's a fantastic Legacy Edition, which contains both of the sets he played that day and everything else as well. So there's the warm-up stuff by Carl Perkins.
It's
really interesting. There's the kind of announcements before the show. So that bit, the kind of very well-known beginning of the album where he says, "I'm Johnny Cash," and then the cheers go in. You hear them setting that up. You hear I think it is Bob, isn't it, from the record, say, "What we'd like you to do is
don't be completely quiet until he comes in. And then when he says, I'm Johnny Cash, cheer. And these lags and murderers and rapists and criminals go, yeah, okay. They're not really cooperative.
It's like any audience, isn't it? It's just like, it's like the X Factor.
Yeah.
Like
happy to be here.
The public service announcements of prisoner 7124 is wanted in reception.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what was that all about? And those guys had to go out. Did they get back in to see the gig? I mean, it's...
Well, it makes a change from, there's a Volvo with its alarm going off in the car park. I could go and attend to it, please. Or Brian's lost his insulin. Could you come and see somebody in a high-vis jacket? Johnny Cash's Live at Folsom Prison. I mean, just one last thing on it. I mean, I mentioned it earlier on. We've kind of had the whole, quote, Men in Black thing. The revival of Johnny Cash seems to have lasted longer than the career of Johnny Cash. And though great though the music is, there is a... Do you think we might be getting a bit cliched now? And the
it's
idea
not
that...
don't you think? I think what's interesting about Johnny Cash is obviously we all want different things from music.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I think particularly young men want is authenticity.
Yeah.
So what he is like is essentially the equivalent of a hip-hop artist. So, you know, he's in prison talking about the stuff that prisoners are affected by in that environment, and they trust him, and they feel like he's one of them. So it is no different from a kind of, you know, proper hip-hop star saying, I dealt drugs and now I can respond to your experience. It's kind of gangster country. And I think that I genuinely think that if he hadn't made this album, people would be less inclined to reclaim him because of that authenticity.
We tend to sort of think of, you know, because the albums he made with Rick Rubin, the American Recordings thing, which was supposedly going to be, well, he's just got one last record in him, and then there's four of them.
Yeah.
It's the longest farewell since Frank Sinatra. A lot of it is fantastic. Some of it is slightly, you listen to it and go, you're kind of over-egging this very nearly dead thing a bit too much here, Rick. And actually, the Johnny Cash I prefer is this Johnny Cash at Folsom around that time,
well, he's also,
when he's full of vigour.
Yeah.
He's also the country and western star that it's okay to like. You know, he's got he had kind of liberal views, liberal for the country. No, nothing problematic. Or he protested against the war in Vietnam. He recorded with Bob Dylan. He was kind of like, you know, on the kind of liberal side of the Nashville scene. And so he's not somebody who, you know...
And
like
also he did wear black, you know, and not be funny about it, he wore black, and that is like a signifier of cool. He didn't kind of, you know, ponce around his stupid cowboy boots.
Whereas some people might actually go, oh, George Jones is a much better singer, but, you know, there's issues there with kind of his treatment of women and his political views, and same with Porter Wagoner and whatever, but actually Johnny Cash, it's like, you know what?
Let's move on and do another album that nobody else likes. Matt Hall, it's your turn to choose your album that nobody else likes. What is it?
It's an album called Burger Habit by a band called Sensation, who were spectacularly unsuccessful in a number of different guises, but who contained at their core a couple of songwriters who were, I think... sadly overlooked, and still are sadly overlooked.
Okay, well, this is the artist formerly known as Soul Family Sensation. They were called Sensation when they put this one out. This is the None More Kevin the Teenager. Tell Your Parents I Hate Their Guts. Sensation to Tell Your Parents I Hate Their Guts from the 1993 album Burger Habit, which is liked by Matt Hall and nobody else. Matt, nobody really thinks that 1993 is a classic year, do they? I mean, they're wrong, because there's Björk and Pulp and all kinds of great stuff, but it's sort of been written out of the classic eras of pop. What do you love about this?
Interesting that you should mention Björk there, because I think one of the big problems for Sensation was that they were signed to One Little Indian, despite being possibly the most un-One Little Indian band that you could ever think of, because what they wanted to make was kind of shiny, kind of shuffly dance pop with lyrics about getting stoned on the hill outside Windsor Castle, because that's where they came from. They were kind of home counties, and they were in a couple of bands kind of like before, like Airstream, and then they were in Soul Family Sensation, and they made a fantastic album with some three or four songs that in an alternative and more just universe would be like number one for like months at a time.
I don't even know if I should call you baby.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. But then their singer, Jaleesa, left to join the Shaman.
Yes.
That's a very 90s, not more 90s, isn't it?
Yeah.
Transfer window Cook, leaving to join the Shaman for an undisclosed fee.
So they kind of like regrouped, dropped the Soul Family, became Sensation, and then made this album, which was just lots of kind of. It's quite an interesting record because it's very. It's kind of looking back. The songs are quite upbeat, quite a lot of them, but they're actually quite elegiac. They're looking back at kind of a more kind of perfect childhood and things that happened.
They're really morose, aren't they?
Yeah,
they've got a song about splitting up with your girlfriend called "Splitting Up with Your Girlfriend." I like
messing around
more direct.
But also, they kind of like throw in things like they've got too many ideas for the for the album. You know, they kind of there's a song which lasts 30 seconds called "Richard and Judy," and it's just basically. Lying in bed watching Richard and Judy. I think that's the lyrics, and then it stops. That, you know, and you kind of think that's a really. I like that.
We made our guests listen to these records that we chose. Miranda Sawyer, what did you reckon? Were you aware of this at the time?
No, not at all. I was like, complete. I was like, what happened to my 90s knowledge? This is appalling. I didn't know this at all.
You and I were doing Select at this time, weren't we? And they were in Select.
I'm pretty sure that I might have even reviewed this for Select or certainly.
I just thought, I have missed this completely. I felt shocked at myself. I was like, was I completely out of it? I didn't know this album at all, and I liked it. I liked it in the same way. It's not quite the same. I actually think that Teenage Fan Club are better, but like, you know, it's kind of like that kind of that wistfulness of Teenage Fan Club. Yeah. They say this is your life, and your life might be small and not kind of amazing, but within it there are amazing pop songs. There's no reason why you can't write a pop song about splitting up with your girlfriend. Everyone does that, but you know what I mean. You know, you can do it, and you can turn your life into something a little bit bigger, and that's what I really liked about it. I mean, I thought it was actually a very sweet album.
When
really
you think about it, it is actually about the boredom economy and the day and when tedium was a thing. Because I don't think anybody is bored anymore, and that's a bad thing. You know, if you're young, you have no reason, you know, not to cram your hours with exciting things. And actually that provides its own burden of anxiety. Why am I not doing amazing stuff? My phone's full of things. Why am I not doing stuff with it? You know, whereas until about 1999, you could reasonably just loll around looking out the window, bored out your skull, writing pop songs called Bored Out My Skull, or I Hate My Parents. And that seems to have evaporated. Yeah. Matt, what you're a...
It's funny you mentioned Teenage Fan Club. I was more reminded of Pulp, really, lyrically, in that kind of encounters with girlfriends and that kind of thing, and kind of quite graphic in the descriptions. And there was that kind of Saint Etienne thing to it. It's interesting because you kind of gave me, in your description there, more than I can find online.
There is nothing about them
anywhere.
Yeah, it's really funny. You put Sensation, you get some terrible band. It's a party band, or a Euro dance festival.
You know what this is? And they could never have foreseen it. Search engine optimization. That's what it is. It's like calling your band the and being amazed that people can't find it on the bloody internet. You know? I mean, a friend of mine was on Facebook the other day saying there is no more frustrating endeavor than trying to get Alexa to play the. Alexa, play the. And just sparks and steam come out of Alexa. But
Burger Habit, you type that in and you just get a chain of fast food restaurants.
But the
only things that I could glean about them was the fact that one of them did go on to write with Sarah Cracknell, and wasn't one of them part of Republic?
They finally had the big hit, but I don't think it... I mean, I've never met them and I don't know, but I seem to remember they weren't the most... forthcoming and pleasant people who, if you wanted them to be pop stars and to play the game.
They needed good press, didn't they? You need good press and also to be good with press, I suppose.
And I think, you know, the problem was that at that point, One Little Indian was a very kind of a very different outfit to what it is now. And if you remember when that first Bjork album came out, it was massive everywhere. Yeah. It was a real surprise. And I think they probably got lost in the kind of slipstream.
I think it was a surprise to One Little Indian as much as anyone else. I remember, actually, people forget when that first Bjork record came out, it didn't really do anything. It came out, the two or three singles came off, it went nowhere, the record wasn't really selling. And then she did a track with David Arden called Play Dead, which was a hit from a flop movie. And then they tacked it onto the record quick, stuck it out again, and then international superstar Bjork. I did discover another interesting thing on Discogs, Matt, which you'll be happy about. There is a third Sensation album.
I have it.
You've got it.
There we are.
They're a bit older and they're a bit more bitter, and it's not as life affirming.
It's not as sunny.
Well, the clue's in the name. It's called Yesterday Things Got Worse.
You can get it for
£1.76 on Discogs, and it only came out in Germany, according to Discogs.
The the best song that I like on this album, well, it's not the best song on the album, is Hate Songs, the chorus of which is, I write hate songs, you work in advertising.
Yes, yes. I actually remember that quite clearly. Yeah. I want to be clear, by the way, we are not the hilarity of the studio, we're not laughing at this band. We are...
Laughing with them,
and we are full of admiration for what they achieved. And frankly, let's face it, Johnny Mayle made probably so much money from Ready to Go by Republica that he's presently in his luxury diamond hovercraft drinking champagne and laughing at us. So yes, that's Burger Habit by Sensation, the album that only Matt Hall likes, but maybe more people like it, I don't know. It's my turn. I'm going to choose my album. I confidently expect every one of you to hate my album that nobody else likes. But if you're going to listen to one psychogeographic mystical new wave disco album from 1992, it should be this one. Shriekback are the unclassifiable band formed by Barry Andrews, who was XTC's keyboard player in the very, very early days. And Sacred City was their semi-concept album about urban mysteries and the cosmic underbelly of the built environment. This is my favourite track. This is called Beatles Zebra Crossing, with a question mark at the end, so it really is called Beetle Zebra Crossing.
They were more popular than God upon this bridge of black and white. The sacred naked feet have trod, seers and angels. They saw what no one saw before, and now with closed eyes, they walk from shore to shining shore. It's still Beetle Zebra Crossing. It's still Beetle Zebra Crossing. It's still Beetle Zebra Crossing. It's still.
From the 1992 album Sacred City, which pretty much nobody likes but me. This is the album in a nutshell on this song, because it's about the Abbey Road Zebra Crossing as an archaeological and religious site akin to Stonehenge or a dolmen in the middle of nowhere.
You could like this, Andrew.
Yeah, and the lyric, there's a lyric, one of the lines is, this was the Holy Land when they were more popular than God. And it also describes how they take, the Zebra Crossing is moved, it's scorched from the road and it's moved up the road. So is it still the same Zebra Crossing? Does it have the same mystery? Just as we reassembled Stonehenge in Victorian times and it's not the way that it was supposed to be. You know, they're finding the cosmic in the everyday. There's a track on this album called Hymn to the Local Gods. So the way that, you know, in ancient societies we would worship the local god of a lake or a pond, or perhaps we should be worshipping the god of Tesco's at the moment, or the god of the local Starbucks, or that kind of thing, or the god of Wi-Fi actually be very useful at the moment. But I just love the fact that, you know, it is a journey into the cosmicness of the everyday, and the cover in particular, which I think is by Tomato, who did Underworld's covers, and it represents the tube map connecting to this kind of central cosmic eye, as if it's like a map of the constellations of the universe. It's the tube, it's the nervous system, it's the inner mind, it's dumped on top of a big image of Eros. You know, the album keeps talking about what it's like to wander through the city and not know where you're going. The opening track is called Signs, and it's all about not just road signs, but also the shape and semiotics of the city. And it's like, do you know what Spurs means?
Do you know what
Millwall means? And it's like, oh, can you read the signs? Can you read the signs? And the idea of that, like, the city is a book, and you've got to try and understand it. And for me, this fits in with all the stuff I like that isn't pop music, like Alan Moore and Ian Sinclair and China Mayville and like Neil Gaiman, and these people who look at the city and go, this is a, I mean, it's a bit kind of, you know, slightly pseudo, but it's a gigantic text to be unravelled. And London being the biggest book of the lot. And it seems to be, like, for me, this is as great a London album as you're going to find. Miranda, you're doing a funny facial expression.
No, it's funny. Because I haven't listened to it as hard as you have, if you saw it to me. So I just listened to it and I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. But I did like it. What I thought, which you can tell even by your introduction to it, is there are so many ideas
in
here.
There's so much going on.
There's so much going on that it is almost like an album made by a journalist. Do you know what I mean? It's like an album made by, I'd really like to do this and this and this and this and this, and I'll put it all in. But initially, when I first heard it was weird that you mentioned the, because it made me think of the, you know, that slightly portentous element. There's a kind of slight feeling that you're hurtling towards doom, which the always kind of has. But also there's a kind of dance element as well. So, you know, it's definitely got the indie feel, but with dance. So that's why I can understand that it would definitely appeal to you, because there's quite a lot of tracks you think, oh, this would sound brilliant on a dance floor, but they're talking completely. Yeah.
But that's the curious thing about Shriekback, though, isn't it? Is that they were around for kind of ages doing this stuff, kind of
Shriek is such a bad name for them as well.
There were so many things that happened. There was the fact that he was kind of like a tall, bald bloke fronting them.
Yeah.
But they were doing this stuff for ages, and then the kind of dance music happened, and Shriek were going,
they were too early for Acid House.
Yeah.
They were almost more about the acid than the house, and I think Barry Andrews in particular is
but
one
so
of those...
were the Shaman, and the Shaman kind of managed to.
But this is, I mean, the Shaman
did make songs called "He's a Good Day."
I won't hear the Shaman being knocked. I think the Shaman were really good, but they were definitely the kind of, in many ways, the decaf version.
They saw their chance and they went for it. Whereas Shriekback were too much kind of like
they were more kind of. Shriekback started, you know, sort of about 1981 or something. They had a whole kind of John Peel session era when it was really kind of.
Isn't Carl Hyde something to do with this as well?
No, because Carl Marsh.
Carl Marx.
maybe he was. I'm not entirely sure.
It's interesting because I listened to it this morning and was reminded of Underworld in certain parts.
Well, that's sort of like weird, sort of like very low level, sort of talking blues, city chatter nonsense that means something and
it means something but means nothing at the same time.
That is in here.
Yeah.
I mean, the funny thing about sort of Shriekback's trajectory, you're right, it's a pretty terrible band name now, but they formed around the time when a session on John Peel was the pinnacle of what you could aim for. And they've made, you know, in the course of the 80s, they made a kind of weird, kind of fungoid funk album, a really kind of fetid, kind of febrile
fungoid
thing. Yeah.
Fungoid.
Really kind of horribly
fungoid,
you know, brilliantly kind of mulchy and kind of loamy record called Jam Science, which they made with a dub producer called Paul Groucho Schmeichel, who was kind of the hot guy on Island Records before, you know, house music and anything else like that. They then made a deep sea heavy metal album about coelacanths. And that's the one with Nemesis on it, which you may know. Big Black Nemesis, Parthenogenesis. The kind of 2000 AD inspired one. You can tell why I love them, can't you? Because they made a song inspired by 2000 AD. So they make this heavy metal album about archaeology and oil and stuff. And it's called Oil and Gold.
It's designed for you.
Yeah. And it's got,
and somehow,
and they've got eels on the cover.
Miraculously, it wasn't a hit.
Yeah, but it wasn't. They weren't even trying to get a hit. They just wanted to make
this, Andrew's heart.
Yeah, they just wanted to make mad records. And then when Acid House happens, weirdly, they try and go pop. So they do this with a cover of a Casey and a Sunshine Band. Right. So they do Get Down Tonight, which is the equivalent of getting, I don't know, it's like trying to get Fat White Family onto the X Factor.
That's so funny.
By the way, also, by then, the singer, who was quite photogenic, had left, and it was Barry was up front, and Barry is completely bald and wears mad John Lennon sunglasses, and he looks like, if anybody's familiar with the comics writer Grant Morrison, he looks like him. He looks like a mad bald man. His body is 60% LSD, and he's singing Casey and the Sunshine Band in an attempt to get on top of the pops while everybody, when they could have been making Acid House and doing it. So they've had a very, very wayward career, and they're back together now, and they're making really good records. They performed live for the first time in like 30 years last year.
Did you go and see them?
I couldn't go. We were away, but by all accounts, it was amazing. But this is the one that I really love, just because it, again, a bit like Johnny Cash, subject matter, artist, band, a lot, all knits together. I mean, there's a song on it called Exquisite Corpse, which is shows the kind
I didn't like that one, I have to say, because I love the title, and I tried to, and I, that
but
was
you
the
know
one
what,
I didn't
I,
like.
I did like that. I
but
really
you know what
that.
The Exquisite Corpse is, don't you? Exquisite Corpse was an art method where it's basically an arty version of, you know, you draw something and you fold it over and give it to somebody else. They don't know what they're drawing.
Yeah.
So you do, you know, you would hand on a half-finished piece of artwork to somebody that they would then complete without knowing what you'd done. So you get this weird chimera kind of griffin thing.
Isn't it also the third part of the quote, live fast, die young? And leave an exquisite corpse.
It could well be. Maybe that's where. I mean, this is sort of futurist and you know, kind of surrealist art. So they may have just pinched it from that. I don't know. Or maybe that's where we got Exquisite Corpse from. I don't know.
But then goes into Below, which is a bit like some kind of end of days soundtrack by Hans Zimmer. Could have been on Blade Runner 2049. Yeah. You know, it's a real mixture of stuff on there.
Yeah. One thing that they are slightly connected to your Golden Dawn Orchestra thing is they have a real Aleister Crowley thing too. They really are into their golden bow and, you know, sort of esoterica and black magic and
all
the rest of it.
Don't put me off.
But the great thing about it is they don't take it seriously. This is not a heavy metal band going, Jimmy Page, let's go and sacrifice a ghost. They have a great sense of humour about everything. Everything to them is both brilliant and funny.
Isn't it strange that the fact that everyone who's into sex magic with K on it is the blokes who never had girlfriends at school?
Well, I think maybe one of the reasons I like Shriekback is I'm a massive drugs coward. I've never really done any, and they've done them all for me.
They're here to tell you.
Yeah, well, I love psychedelic music. but I'm terrified to actually like go and get involved myself. So it's great to encounter people who've done, they've kind of done the research for you. Done,
but every, I mean, I have to say, Andrew, that's pretty much all the music you like. I mean, that is all the music you like. Is it heavily drug influenced, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I am such a coward. Anyway, so that's Sacred City by Shriekback, which is basically your cosmic Oyster card to other dimensions within zones 1 to 9, you know, and I recommend it. So we're going to put all of these albums on the Facebook page, the Spotify links, because luckily they're all on Spotify, and people can listen to them and decide whether they like them or not as well. And I think that's probably the show in a bag. That's the end of the show. Thanks to our guests, Miranda Sawyer and Matt Allen, for coming in and for sharing your records that nobody else likes. Did you think that the ones that we played, did you make you want to go, I'm going to give that one another go?
I was really, you know, I'm always really happy to be introduced to new music. And it's always that really brilliant thing where you just think, well, why do I not know about this? I can't believe I don't know about it. And that's just, you know, brilliant.
I think you may find our choices stranger than we found yours. You may struggle to kind of go to
well, you know what? I thought I was pleasantly surprised that none of them were the kind of. It wasn't. I didn't feel there was any kind of critical point scoring or.
Yeah. No, everyone was very honest.
And they're all kind of like. They all have a theme of pop music going through them, which enables you to kind of latch on, I think.
I'm definitely going to try and see Golden Dawn Orchestra.
If you're ever in Texas and they play, you have to go. Okay. I mean, it's so rare.
But watch out for the Black Widows.
Yeah, they're going to make you take drugs, Andrew.
Oh, my God. Do you have to dress up?
No, but I'd like to see you try.
Okay, well, I'll get my pharaonic headdress out. So thank you for coming in, lovely guests, and thank you, Matt, for producing the show, and thank you for listening, listeners. Remember, you can hear this episode again and all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. And if you have a moment in your busy schedule, please go on Apple Podcasts and give us a star rating and a review to help spread the word of the show. We're going to be back again next week with more high and low-end pop talk. Until then, from me, Matt, and Miranda, goodbye and have a lovely week.